Hello and welcome to anybody who is watching along. And we are very, very glad you're here. I want to remind anybody who's watching, what you're watching. This is the second meeting that Creating the Future is doing our communications strategy. And if you are watching and would like to tweet to us, the hashtag is Creating the Future. So please join us. I know that at least one person is watching. And Mark, if you would like to tweet, we've now outed you to everybody who is out there. Let's start with just some introductions. We are, once again, a small group, and it is really fun. If you read the summary of the last meeting and our conversation in the last meeting, if you do meetings of groups that are just sort of volunteering to come together around something, it is not unusual for 12 and 15 people to say, I will absolutely be there. And then an hour before to start saying, my car won't start, my kid is sick. And so often groups say, well, we'll just cancel and we'll reschedule. And what happens is the next time when they reschedule it, different group shows up, but it's still only four people. And eventually they come to the realization that if the conversation they have is inclusive, then let's just move forward. And so I am just very, very happy that you all are here. It just said it's now streaming. So if you weren't streaming, welcome and hello. The hashtag, if you are watching and would like to tweet to us, is Creating the Future. And the full recording of the couple of minutes that you missed will be posted after we're done here. Let's do some introductions. And I'm just going to sort of go on where people are on my screen. I met Anne Vermel years ago. When you were living in Fresno, and we have worked together for over a decade and been friends for over a decade. And Anne is one of the most multi-talented people I know. And has had many delicious lives, including running nonprofit organizations and being an opera singer, and everything in between that you can imagine. It is just joyful to have you be part of this today. And can you just tell us where you are and what is exciting in your life these days?
I'm in Fort Collins, Colorado, reinventing myself, and that's what's exciting in my life. I moved here 3 months ago, Beatrice, and I uprooted myself entirely from a life that I've been living for a little over 20 years. And I also discovered all of a sudden I have days and days and days where there's no real direction that I have to follow. So I'm discovering, and it's quite marvelous.
and I love hearing your discoveries. So I'm really glad you're here. I'm really glad you're here. I had the good fortune of meeting Beatrice when I was in Florida last year, right around this time. Mm-hmm. Yes. You were doing some work with the Patterson Foundation. I was doing some work with the Patterson Foundation. And there is just this lovely spirit that exudes from Beatrice. I'm so pleased you're here. I know that you have relocated from Florida to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So I'm eager to hear what is going on in your life that you're excited about.
Oh, thank you so much. And Anne, I resonate a lot with your story because, yeah, I just moved to D.C. 7 months ago, uprooted myself from Florida, where I had been living for 9 years. And so right now I'm working with the largest advocacy and civil rights organization for the Latino community, Unidos U.S. It used to be called the National Council of La Raza. And so I'm there in the communications department, and yeah, just reinventing myself a little bit as well, and living a really love story with this city.
That is awesome. It's interesting that the last meeting that we had, there was Peter Panapento, who will hopefully be joining us in a little while, and Justin Pollock, both of whom are in Washington, D.C., so I'm going to have to connect you guys. The last one on my screen is Dimitri Petropoulos, and my partner in crime and partner in life. And talk a little bit, I'm going to mute so that you can get on yours, and talk a little bit, Dimitri, about what is exciting in your life these days.
Thanks, Hildy. First of all, I am not in DC. I am in Tucson, Arizona with Hildy. And actually, she's like right over there, which on your screen may or may not be where she is. But hey, hello. Small office. What's exciting is that we have an upcoming trip that we have been working very, very hard. I should say Hildy's been working super hard on. Where we're going to be in Northern California. She's giving a keynote speech that I'm sure she'll talk more about in a little bit. And we get to talk to many, many amazing folks, which is, this is the second year that we are in that area. And many of these visits and people we're talking to were generated in the first visit, which is amazing. And then the end cap to that is that our three kids all live in that area. My eldest lives in the Bay Area, so we're going to see him first. And then at the tail end of the trip, we'll be going through LA, and we will see Lizzie and Derek. So it's kind of a treat to be able to not only spread the word of Creating the Future and the amazing work that Hildy's been doing, but also we get to do a little family time while we're doing it. So. That's what I'm kind of excited about.
So the magic that has to happen because we're sitting next to each other is if my speaker and my microphone are on and Dimitri has one of his on, then everything shakes and reverberates. So every time he has to talk, which is awesome, I need to push a lot of buttons to turn stuff off. What's exciting in my life these days is that we are heading to California, and the amount of stuff that was generated. Last year we spent 2 months, and it was right after I saw you, Beatrice, in Florida. Came home, and 2 weeks later we got into our car and left for 2 months. Headed to California. It was really a community engagement tour for Creating the Future. And meeting people, connecting with people, having people connect us with other people, and hosted a dinner for us, and did a had us do a workshop in Fresno. We spent probably 2 weeks in the Bay Area, 2 weeks in LA, and it was just wonderful planting seeds. And so it's really fun to see what grew out of that when you're engaging for the purpose of engaging and having conversation, and not to try and sell something or raise money, or just for the purpose of connecting people to what we're doing. And so I'm doing, in the next, starting a week from tomorrow, I am doing a keynote, a 4-hour workshop, 2 guest lectures at UC Berkeley, then a community-wide workshop, and that's all in 2 weeks. So it's been a writing frenzy and a imagining frenzy, which is really fun, is imagining what's possible when people are experiencing what catalytic thinking can do, what it can feel like, what it can mean. So that's pretty awesome. That is pretty awesome. I want to give grounding both to all of us who are here together, to anybody who may be watching. Dimitri's going to keep an eye on the Twitter stream if anybody is out there playing, and to especially anyone who is watching in the recording afterwards, because we know that's frequently where the ripples happen. The purpose of our deciding to do a communication strategy is really because we are at a turning point in Creating the Future's existence. We are realizing that we spent the first several years of our work in proof of concept, is probably the best way to put it. That we were applying catalytic thinking to both the work that we were doing internally as an organization to experimenting with others in demonstration projects. And then we were taking what we were learning from that, and when people were taking our classes, what they were learning as they were applying it. And we were sharing that out in education programs and speeches and building communities and any way that we could learn and then take what we learned and share what we learned. And we've gotten to the point now where it is clear we are ready to move from small groups learning at a time, small projects individually one at a time. Our board has been working for the past several years to restructure the organization so that the work we're doing can be more global, can have a really global reach, because the mission of Creating the Future is that people have the skills to change the systems they find themselves in. So they don't need a consultant to come in, or they don't need a, that anybody can change the questions they ask and thereby create systems that bring out the best in people, because so often our systems are aimed at the worst in us, are aimed at, and frequently when I say that, the first thing people say is, oh, you mean like human resources, which is all about making sure that you don't mess up, and when you do, here's what's going to happen. What does it look like when we build systems that are around bringing out the best in people rather than punishing people or predicting that they're going to do something wrong? And so to have a more global impact is going to require, among other things, it's going to require that we have the platform for that, and that's what we've been working on with the board. It is going to require that our programs shift, which is a big part of what's coming up over, has been for about the past 6 months and is continuing to evolve, and absolutely going to need a communication strategy. Things like, if we're trying to figure out what is next and where we want to step into next, it would be really nice for people to know what we're trying to do. And when we, I mean, it seems pretty simple. If we decide that what we want to do is to support whatever we're going to do by crowdfunding, people are going to need to know what we want to. So at every point in building a program and building out what we're trying to do, it is very, very clear that communications is at the heart of that. And so let me bring up on my screen where we are in the catalytic thinking framework so that we're all on the same page. For those who are familiar with catalytic thinking, or if you're not, no matter what situation presents itself, the first thing we do is we listen. We listen to what people are telling us, what we're hearing out in the world. And some of the things that have linked to this meeting in the blog, which if you're watching right now and you want to link back, what you'll find is many of the discussions that led to our deciding we wanted to do this. And all of that was through listening, having conversations and listening. The next thing that we do as we go, okay, we've listened and now we want to start thinking about taking action. The first thing that we do is say, okay, people are going to be impacted by our work. Whatever actions we decide to take, people are going to be impacted by that, whether we intend that or not. And so whose lives might be affected by any action that we take? And we listed those last time. We spent a good deal of time saying who might hear these actions that we take from this communication strategy? And then asking from there, what do we want that to make possible? When they see those communications, whatever they are, it could be a tweet, it could be a keynote speech, it could be an article someplace. When those individuals who are going to see it, whether they're our quote-unquote target audience or not, when they see that, what do we want that communication to make possible for them? And we listed those out last time. And so what we're going to be spending time on today, let's see if I can undo, there we go. I'm going to do a quick review from the blog post that you may have seen describing this. And I know several of the people in this room were either there or have actually listened to the meeting. But we're really going to start asking, okay, for those outcomes to be real, what needs to be in place? What is the cause and effect that will lead to those outcomes? So it is a very causality-driven way of looking at things, because what we realize is that the purpose of communications and eventually our actions will create those conditions. The purpose of communications, which is going to be an action, is to create the conditions so that we can create those successful outcomes. And so I am going to stop the share right now. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to prioritize out of those high potential outcomes that we talked about last time, prioritize which seem to be the most important for creating the future's mission and work. It's not as if we're going to ignore the rest of them. We're going to keep them in mind as we're doing our work. But we're going to say these are the most important things for us to focus on right now. And we may come back to others later and go, you know what? This group we want to really pay attention to. We've already outlined it. But really today is we're going to prioritize and then start looking at the conditions that need to be in place for this to happen. I see Beatrice is nodding, so I'm sensing this makes sense to you. I know this makes sense to Anne and Dimitri because this is not your first rodeo here. And so I'm just going to share a little bit of what we came to last time. As we start to think about what are the most important of these outcomes that we want to really reach for. We noted that the people who are going to be affected by our communications are in general leaders in any social change efforts. So those could be organizational leaders, they could be foundations, they could anybody who's leading or sees themselves as a leader in social change efforts. From there, there's the people who generally self-identify as I'm just an employee at an organization. I'm just a citizen. So there's those folks who feel like they have no positional authority to create change in their systems. And they're the ones who don't know they have power. And through the questions that they ask, they find their power, which is always exciting to see. Another group is going to be teachers of all kinds within the social change arena. And that could be a nonprofit resource center. It could be consultants. It could be folks in academia who are teaching anything from public administration to social enterprise. And the students who are learning from those teachers. Then there's supporters of community change efforts. So those could be donors, those could be foundations, those could be volunteers, those could be folks who save up food to bring to the food bank, anybody who is supporting those efforts. And there's frequently a fine line between that and activists, but we are seeing so much delicious and delightful activism these days, which is really heartening. This has been a week of that, although this has been several years of that, and globally several years even more. And finally, people in community who again see themselves as I'm just a person. I just live in my neighborhood. I don't do anything special except I do a potluck once a week. Oh, you do? You bring everybody in for yes? Well, it's just my neighbor. It really is amazing how many of us. Feel we're just, which is basically saying we don't feel we're enough. And the beauty of changing the systems that we live in so that it honors the participation of everybody and says, hey, look what you're doing. It's remarkable how many people we talk to who say, I don't really do very much. I'm thinking when we were in Fresno last year, on the tour that we were doing, Anne introduced us to a young man who owns a breakfast place. And, we go to breakfast places, and by 2:00, the breakfast place shuts down. This guy sees himself as just a citizen and just a guy who owns just a little breakfast place. But he opened up his breakfast place at 6:00 at night so that all of his friends could come and we could all just chat about what a social change looked like to you. We don't realize the extent to which we are doing all of these amazing things when we see ourselves as not enough and seeing that power happens here and not the power that we all have, which is such a big piece of why we're doing the work we're doing. So if anyone is watching and you have other groups that you think we haven't covered in all of this, and Anne and Beatrice, if you think in looking through as you were preparing that there's groups that we didn't cover, time on in. And we can start looking at what we had determined were the outcomes for all them beeps.
By the way, I know that Mark Friesen liked the tweet earlier of you, so I know he's at least watching that. So,
Mark. very fun. Very fun. When we looked at, and again, you saw in the graphic of the framework, that the first thing we do is reach really high. We reach really high for what are the outcomes. It's so interesting when folks do traditional strategy, two things that we do. First, we look at goals, but we generally don't look very high. We want to increase, you know, readership, viewership, or we want to increase numbers, or and we generally don't look at what's the ultimate why of that. Okay, if we increase all those numbers and we go from 4,000 subscribers to 20,000 subscribers, or we do whatever, what will that make possible for all of those other people? Not for us. What will it make possible for them? Because they're what our mission is about. We're not what our mission is about. They are what our mission is about. What will it make possible for them? And so that reaching very, very, very high, and also being inclusive to say, let's not narrow down a target audience just yet. Let's understand that all these people are going to see it, whether they're our, quote, target audience or not. There's plenty of time to narrow down later. But for right now, let's sort of hold the space for everyone, because our mission isn't just about, you know, these people over here. It's about all of us together. So as we looked at that high potential, we talked about people having personal agency to create systems change, feeling like they have the power to create systems change, which also goes with the next one, which was having the courage to create systems change. We talked about people seeing the power of following rather than having to be the leader, because that's what usually takes the courage, is stepping out on the ledge rather than saying, oh, I'll attend a meeting that everyone else is at and I'll just sit quietly. There's power in that and understanding that. The power of seeing the big picture, which frequently gets lost when we're in the doing. The high potential of being able to demonstrate so that people could actually see, oh, that's what it looks like. I see that. There's a story I can connect to. I got all of the theory, but oh, this is what it really looks like. The power to start new conversations and the power to connect with others who want the same results. So as we look at those outcomes, I think probably I'm going to type those into the chat box so that we can all look at them together. Let me do that real fast.
So as you were going over them, Sylvie, and I'll speak up so that hopefully everyone can hear. Each one of the, you know, because she has been on my mind a lot lately, and that's Greta Thunberg, each one of those things she's doing, or she's being. Personal agency to create change, the courage to create systems change, the power of following, seeing the big picture, demonstrating, showing versus telling, starting new conversations, connecting with others who want the same results. Every single one of those things is what she is embodying, and it's why she is so effective, it's so powerful, and why people are in movement with them. So it's interesting. I was reflecting on that as you were going over those or reviewing those. So, yeah. Wow, when you see it in action, you know, the demonstrating is she took a sailboat, you know, to come across the Atlantic. It was not because she's going to save X pounds of carbon. It was to make it, to use it as an example. This is what you can do to do that. So
pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Pretty powerful. So when we think about what we are trying to do at Creating the Future and trying to looking at our expanding our work to really have a global impact so that folks can change the systems they find themselves in, which of these feel the most important?
You're referring to the ones that are shown in the chat box. For me, the connecting with others that wants the same results as well as starting new conversations, I think that it's very, very powerful. Because what you said, sometimes we feel that we are in just a box, that we don't find those people that are having like the same concerns, and you feel powerless, like I'm just. And I know that I've had that feeling for a while. Not thinking that, you know, from all the things that are happening in the world, what am I bringing? What is the meaning of everything that I'm doing? And I know that many of the people around me feel the same way. And we see ourselves as such a small part, but then I always remember the ripple effect and how that expands. And what Dimitri was just saying about Greta and how she's now planting that seed in so many other people, realizing that we do have power, that you just have to take that first step.
Beautiful, yeah.
I think that's actually the first place that it starts. Because if you are someone who does not feel that you have the power, very often meeting the people who want the same results will give you that sense that, oh, I do have the power. So I would actually put that before what would had originally been my first thing, which was personal agency to create change.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's a great point. And because I was at the same place. I was thinking that personal agency to create change was the first thing that has to be in place. But how do you get that? And what you're talking about is a way of nurturing that or growing that within us, within an individual. So that's great.
I am loving, because I think what you hit on, Beatrice, is that it's not the highest potential. People having agency and having courage, joining together, following, and starting new conversations may be a higher potential, but the key precondition to all of those is that we find each other.
That's true.
Yeah, that you know, what you all have just been saying, it's the place where we can hear other people's stories, the demonstrating, the showing versus telling. It's a place where we can feel our agency, get courage, sense that power of following. Awesome. Yeah, and so what we had said last time, if our messages are successful, people who are seeking the same results will feel encouraged to connect and to explore together what is possible. Jaded professionals in the social change arena could experience what it feels like to participate meaningfully, especially foundations and donors, versus the lip service so that we can get something from them. It was so interesting. Years ago, Dimitri and I were working with a foundation on a project that was very hands-on. The foundation was working side by side with folks in the community, mostly organizational leaders in the community, and we were the liaison between them all. We were the glue. It was a learning community, and we were holding all of it together so that they all could learn together and do these brilliant things that they were all doing. And it became so clear so fast that foundation leaders can never trust the motivations for why someone is coming to them just to have a conversation. Because at some point, they always know that they're looking at them and going, yeah, well, you can make a decision about, could you give me money? Could you give me money now? Could you? And that you never knew when somebody was actually being honest. You never knew when they were. And so the ability to demonstrate what it looks like to actually be connecting meaningfully without wanting something from somebody. For either of the two prongs of our future work, the power of all of us together is necessary, especially as we're not looking to necessarily own a program or project, but instead want to participate with others who are on the same path. If our message is successful, those messages will help create connections and show what connection looks like for other people. So here's what we're going to go next, and I'll just bring this back up on the screen so everybody can be on the same page. We're going to start asking what conditions will lead to those outcomes. What will all those individuals need to have? What will they need to feel? What will they need to believe? What will they need to be assured of? Because conditions for success are always about people. If it's about stuff, it's because people need the stuff. It's not just because there's money sitting on a desk someplace. It's because somebody needs something for something. And so we're really going to be looking at the conditions for success, knowing that our communicating is a condition for success. So what we say and how we say it is going to be a condition for our success if we're able to connect with others and help others connect with each other. So for people to connect around, so specifically, let me share a little bit more about what we're looking to do. And they're in two places. One is around sharing our education programs so that people don't need to come to Creating the Future for a program, that anyone can teach it anywhere. So if it is in academia, a university professor can take some of our modules maybe and infuse that into their programs. Last year, Fresno State used our class on collective enoughness in one of their sustainability classes for fundraising. So those kinds of things, we will have a lot more ripple if people are taking our education programs and teaching them rather than we have to be the ones teaching them. So really being a distribution system for the knowledge and the content rather than having to be the ones out there teaching. So that's one piece of what we want to connect with people about. And that's huge for people to be able to connect around that to say, oh, that might be me. And the other big piece is looking to shift the systems that support social change so that all of those systems align more with the values and vision that we all want to see in the world. That's a big one. That is the one that we don't know what that project is going to look like, even if it is going to be a project. We don't know if it's just going to be starting a conversation, gathering people together to have conversations, sparking the conversations, and we don't know what's going to come of those conversations. But let's focus on that one first, just because it's big and it's hairy and it's out there, and I've started blogging a little bit and started having a little bit of conversations with folks primarily in the capacity building world, but pretty much everywhere now. Looking at the fact that so many of the systems that are supposed to support social change actually go, they actually perpetuate exactly what we're all trying to change. So for instance, if funding has all of the power dynamics that come with valuing money over people, and the people with money make the decisions about who gets funded and whose program, you, Anne, get to do your program and Dimitri, you don't get to do yours, rather than, hey, we all care about the same thing. We're creating dynamics that actually go counter to what we want. If we want to build equity in the world, do we have equitable systems for supporting social change? No, not at all. So looking at some of those systems and saying, the top-down organizational charts that we're all so used to, the board and then the CEO and then the staff and the volunteers, how much change can you possibly effect in that hierarchical system that may have made sense in the military for winning battles, but does it make sense for having a global reach of a concept in the system? So if we're looking to connect with people around that big thing, and we're looking at connecting with all those individuals that we talked about, from people who are supporting social change, people who are teaching around social change, people who are in community, activists. What do folks, if we want to have those conversations and start sparking a global change in how we support social change, what do people need to know? Let's start with that. What do the people we want to speak with need to know if we want to connect with them and start creating those ripples?
They need to know what Greta Thunberg said: your house is on fire.
Yeah.
They need to know that it's really necessary and urgent.
I love it.
And that change is actually possible when we get together to have these conversations and seeing the power on actually getting together and having an action plan and starting these conversations.
That works. Yeah,
that there's hope.
The hope. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, you don't tell somebody their house is on fire unless you can say there's a hose over there.
I mean, also in that, stretching that metaphor out a little bit more, and
beat it hard.
It helps if there's smoke to point to. So, part of it is the message. Part of it is examples of, this is why it's not working. You talked about the sort of hierarchical command structure, Tony, and that can be very effective in very specific circumstances. But from a continuing standpoint, we want to create an equitable society that involves everybody everywhere. That command structure requires like a individual at the top, as opposed to everybody working together. So it's really important to see that the efficacy of this and the long-term sustainability, and that's really what came to my mind, the sustainability, that knowing that everyone's involved is what makes this sustainable and not dependent on a leader, charismatic or not, someone at the top of the totem pole, because if everyone's involved, it transcends that person. It becomes about everyone, not about one person.
The thing that just like smacked me when you said that, what people need to know is that the current way we're doing things is not sustainable. One of the talks that I'm giving in California is around reimagining philanthropy and the title that was given to it is, can your .org make it in a hashtag world? And what it's really talking about is a .org is an organization. working on its own. And the hashtag is, you look at Me Too, you look at, it's everybody together. And what is very, very clear in this transitional time that we're in is that GivingUSA is reporting that last year donations are down for the first time in 10 years. And the Chronicle had an article that something like 50-something percent of everyone that is currently in a fundraising job is thinking of leaving within the next 2 years. And not just leaving their organization, leaving the field. What we're doing isn't sustainable.
Yeah.
And that's big, Dimitri. Thank you.
Yeah, too. Because of you, Dimitri, I took the whole thing. So the house is on fire, but this can be dealt with. Here's the smoke, see? So that means it's not really sustainable. It's going to burn. And it's going to take all of us to put it out and then rebuild.
This time, instead of straw, we'll make it out of bricks. So, taking one more metaphor.
Enough with the metaphor. I'm in the command and control mode. I'm the CEO at the top saying, we're done with the metaphor.
Okay. But I know somebody who owns a brickyard.
We're done. Yeah. Well, and truly, that it will take all of us. And I think, you know, it's starting to build back in some of those other things that we said we wanted this to make possible. What they need to know is that, it just in terms of that, of the ability to connect, is that anybody can make that decision. That we don't have to wait for a top down to say, okay, so I work at an organization and I'm just fill in the blank. I don't have to wait for the CEO to say, we're going to work with these three other organizations. I can go have lunch and start that conversation, and we can bubble things up from the bottom. I think that there's a huge power in realizing it doesn't take huge steps, and we don't have to have a meeting of all the powers that be, that it can bubble up from the bottom. So there's something really powerful in that anybody can reach out to connect. So again, if we're talking about connecting, about shifting the systems that support social change, and we're talking about connecting in many cases with the people who are keeping those systems alive, connecting with foundation leaders, connecting with academics, connecting with those, what do they need to feel? What do those specific individuals who are currently teaching putting out the rules, what do they need to be assured of in that conversation?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. As we're talking about reimagining the systems that support social change, from governance and boards to fundraising to resourcing to evaluation, as we're looking at all those systems and we want to connect with people to have conversations about that, we want to connect sometimes with the people who are actually perpetuating those systems. Mm-hmm. What would they need to be assured of to have the conversation with us? There's something there about, and it's going to be in the negative so we can reframe it, but that they're not going to be put on the spot, that we're not going to wag fingers at them?
Yeah, that they're not, that we're not there to tell them that everything they've done for the last 40 years doesn't work.
Right. So what are we there to tell them then? If we don't want to put them on the spot, what do we want them to feel?
Valued. You know, that keying off of Anne's comment, that there is value in you, there is value in your work, and how do we incorporate that into, hopefully you're talking to someone who agrees that, you know, that this is somewhat of a swirl wheel here in their life and in their work, that agrees that nothing is changing dramatically. They wanted to, you know, I can't imagine that people are in any of these roles because they don't want it to work. You know, they do want it to work. So if you honor them for their wanting it to work, and that there is value in everything that people do, that humans do, if you look at it, you know, in terms of all this big, huge picture, you know, how do we work together? So they need to feel that they're needed. And that they have things to contribute to this, and that it's not, as you started out saying, you know, a wag of finger or a, you know, in the dumpster, you know, you're passe, we don't need you anymore, or you know, the more people engage, the better it is, because who knows what ideas they've got that they've never been able to implement, They see and they have a very specific filter that they're looking at this part of the world through that we're not. So they are seeing things that we're not seeing. You know, we may see the outcomes of it, but that outcome may be because of 14 things that they saw happen that they couldn't do anything about.
So their own agency.
Right. Right.
And I'm thinking as well that it's showing them, like, times are changing, things are changing. The way that people learn, connect, live is different than everything that we've done before. And even there might be already examples out there in whatever area they're working on that can be shown as an example of how things can be done differently. And again, of course, not finger pointing at anyone and understanding that what they brought to the table, it worked. But that things are evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are two sort of states of mind that hit the leadership in these times. One is, I'm totally up against a wall and stuck because the world is not changing the way we envisioned it would. I mean, we run food bank and we're not eradicating hunger, you know. And that's just not the way I wanted it to be when I started out. So that's one thing. The other one is, I'm just a small food bank in a very small town, and I do not realize that I am contributing to the big picture of stopping world hunger.
So a piece of what they need to feel is they need to see that bigger picture of the impact of what their work could be.
Well, remember the very first time that I heard you speak?
I do.
Do you remember what happened there?
You
asked everybody in the room knew their mission, and 45 people knew their mission. And 40 of them said their mission. And then you said, gosh, that's a lot of different missions. You guys are really, really, really doing a lot of things in the community. You've got a lot of missions. They all went, oh yeah, we do. And you said, no, you don't. You have one mission. You want to make Fresno a better place to live. And that's really the thing that makes everybody say, ah, yeah.
It changes the dynamic of value that they feel, that, you know, as opposed to, you know, I'm doing this alone to feed people in Fresno. No, I'm working with everybody else so that the quality of life in Fresno all these other organizations, agencies, people, the quality of life in Fresno is amazing, is better. Is, you know.
That immediately makes me talk to the guy who's working with literacy in the Latina community, you know? It's immediate, and since I really like him and he's cool, it's very nice to be able to talk to him because now we're doing the same thing.
Right.
And we're no longer in competition.
Well, and you all were talking before about they need to feel honored for the work that they're doing and they need to be feel valued. And where I'm hearing the and is they need to be feel valued for their contribution, their existing contribution to making the community a better place. They need to feel heard and listened to. Yeah. And as you were talking about, Beatrice, about they need to know and feel that the times are changing, that what they were doing may have worked when it worked, but that things are shifting, and that can be exciting. Because so frequently. Yeah.
And what Anne was saying as well, bringing people together to do to have that one mission. We are making Fresno or whatever place a better place. And sometimes we just see each other so much as competition that we don't realize that la unión hace la fuerza, right? Coming together, it gives us a strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And okay, so now, I love this, my head's going ding, 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 ding. It's not just existing organizations that are doing the same thing. So it's not so six food banks. And it's not just a food bank and a literacy group and a domestic violence organization, but it's also how we envision, and we all envision it, the hierarchy of the system, because regardless, we're just an organization and you're the foundations. You're the government who's giving us the money for the programs. If we can eliminate that hierarchy, if we can bring people together and say, we're all part of the same system and we all have a part in that, that's a really different, it's a conversation that I think frequently folks who are in those power positions give lip service to, but dear God, please don't take away my power in this. And people in the lower strata of just us organizations say in frustration, well, we're all part of the same system, but they'll never listen to that. And so I think there's a big piece of, and you all are talking about examples. I think there's a big piece of demonstrating what that looks like when that hierarchy goes away.
Actually, that's an elephant in the room and it needs to be discussed.
One of the things I've seen so much, right, is that ego that all these organizations, the ones on the top have, right, of wanting to keep that so much as their baby, and they are the only ones that are experts and it's just frustrating because, again, sometimes they get so focused maybe on the ways that things have been done, that they are not willing to open and see the new waves or the new trends, new things that continue coming up.
And it negates the ability to learn from each other. And there's something really powerful in that. I'm thinking about two different examples. I'm thinking about when Dimitri and I were expanding the diaper bank that we started here in Tucson, and we were looking to expand up in Phoenix. And what we did was we convened people up in Phoenix to build their own diaper bank. And we would meet from in one organization to the next. They would host, you know, and there were 30 or 40 of us all getting together. And so it was going to be primarily larger organizations, but not necessarily. Somebody might have access to a space. And we were at one of the, probably the biggest in the Phoenix area, domestic violence organizations. And there was someone in the group who was trying to build the diaper bank with us, who was from a very tiny domestic violence organization. And what we would do is every time we would start out or end the meeting by having a tour of whoever's place we were at. So honor them for thank them for being there. And this gal at the small organization whispered to the two of us, I've always wanted to see this place. You're doing the same work. Why are you not? I mean, it was just the ability to learn from each other is totally gone when we have exactly what you were talking about, Beatrice. I'm also thinking about in a for-profit setting, there's an investment company in Minneapolis, Riverbridge Investors. They formed the company 30 years ago. And this is, I mean, you want to talk for-profit. Investment company is like the profit part of, you know, that's where the money sits. The founders were working at a large brokerage firm. You know, we all know the names of all the large brokerage firms. And what they realized very quickly is that because bonuses were structured, like translate this as I'm saying it into the foundation world, bonuses were structured on whoever in the office had the most sales. And so you're forcing your salespeople to compete. They therefore, A, were doing a lot of buying and selling and buying and selling, because in that way, you increase your commissions. Was not in the client's best interest at all, but they were also hoarding information. Because if I tell you, then you're going to use that to make more sales with your customers. And nobody had the complete picture. And the only ones making any money were not the clients. It was all the stockbrokers. And they said, this is ridiculous. And they left. They created their own investment firm. And their bonuses are rooted in, they do a 360 review of everyone in the office, and they ask only one question. And that question is, how did that person, or to what extent did that person make you better at your job? And so you think about the foundation world as, okay, this is the, we give it out and we make you compete, versus rewarding shared learning. And again, it's an example, it's a story, and that's a lot of what we're talking about. The demonstrating what it looks like. But there, in what you were talking about, Beatrice, when we're forcing competition, it's not just about money and survival. We don't ever have the whole picture. Everybody's got a different piece of the learning, and nobody's pulling it all together and saying, what if we all learned all of this?
Now, Beatrice mentioned ego.
I'm gonna turn off mine and
Beatrice, you mentioned ego, and you know there's a reward that you get, a psychological reward that you get when you're the leader or your organization. I was going to use the word trumps, but I'll use a different word. When your organization bids or you know gets contracts or you know has more clients or you know whatever. So what I'm sort of playing with the idea is that somehow in all of this, there needs to be that kind of reward for the new way of thinking, the new way of being. So, and Hilda, you were given the example just now, which made me think about this, that you're rewarded because of what you did for everyone else, not because of how much money you made, but because you will make more money. I mean, that's just a byproduct of what rewards you. So I think it's really important to think about, you know, what rewards are people going to get? Because if we're talking to people who are in entrenched is not the right word, but you know, who have been working in a position, part of the sector or part of the whatever for decades, and you present a new plan, well, you know, if they A, can't see themselves as part of that plan, and B, get no reward if they do, then they have no incentive to support it, and they may have incentive to oppose it. It's more comfortable to, you know, continue down the path. You know, what I was thinking is, I've got the best table in the dining room, and I'm not getting up the dining room of the Titanic.
you know, but I've got the best table, so I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to relinquish this table. And so it's that, you know, the big, you know, what is the big picture, whatever, but how am I being rewarded psychologically, emotionally, organizationally for, and I'm talking about people who are in those positions, you know, even if they understand that the world has changed, times have changed, you know, they're thinking of quitting or whatnot, I think there still needs to be some kind of incentive for them based on, during this transition in way of thinking, based on what they're accustomed to in terms of their reward system.
So again, my brain's... one of the things that I have noticed and been following in all of the years that I've been doing all of this research and experimenting is that there is a huge difference brain science-wise when we are competing for end results versus competing for the means to do that work. So if you've got a Richard Branson and a Elon Musk and a Jeff Bezos who all want to get to either the moon or to Mars or to wherever, and they want to be the first, great. They're going to compete, and they're going to, because they're in a race. I mean, I want to get to the end of the race. When you're competing for the means to survive, that all triggers all of the fear center in the, so I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to do whatever because I'm competing to survive. And that's the difference is what we have in the social change arena is we're forcing people. It's the Hunger Games thing. We are forcing people to compete for the means to survive versus rewarding in different ways. If everybody knew they had enough, if everybody felt they had enough, and we could have whatever kind of competitions, whatever kind of you get to win, you get to be the best, you get to be awesome, you get to be whatever, to feed that desire to win, as you were talking about, Dimitri. So long as we're not making people compete and win at, oh good, we got funding and you didn't, so nanny nanny boo boo, and that's where we go. But that's that just sparked. Thank you for that, Dimitri. That was, yeah. Is what are we competing for? And I think that again, that comes back into what do people need to know in order to have these conversations.
Well, what you're saying is they need to know that they will survive, that they're not, there is no mastodon coming for them, that otherwise what you're saying also, it's not otherwise, it's and, you are saying also that for some 100,000 years of human history, we have been fighting to survive. And it's ingrained in the culture to hold on to the security that you know. So what you're asking, I think what we're looking toward is creating recognition that there is another goal, another security, if you will, that you want to accomplish and that you can accomplish.
Yeah, I think it's twofold. It is knowing that there is another goal and understanding that what we believe is just reality is this 100,000 years of human culture that we've created because 100,000 years ago we had to focus on survival. And it's the understanding that, oh, okay, yeah, frequently it's things like, how many times do we hear we could feed the world a million times over? And yet we also believe as, quote, reality that there will always be poor people. well, does there have to be? If we're looking at resources in a different way, are we? So there's a big piece in what you're saying, Anne, in terms of the way things. I think there's a pulling back the curtain to show here's what's really going on. Here's why we react the way we do, because this is the story we've told ourselves over and over and handed down generation to generation, that things are scarce, therefore you must compete. When in fact, it is when people come together and don't compete that they accomplish so much. There's so much in what you just said. It's just,
yeah. That's a demonstration that we should be keep in mind, is when people come in together, they accomplish more. I think seeing, the first thing is, I mean, one of the things that I noticed in the notes that you sent out from the first session was that you had things being accessible and meeting people where they are. They had to be easy to understand. And I added to that list that the result had to be credible.
Talk more.
You had to believe it. You had to, you know, you, I mean, this is how terrible things can happen, because people get persuaded by propaganda. So in a sense, what we're saying is, what our message is a reality check. And so, yeah, that's as far as I can go with that.
No. It is really looking at the question of, and let's dive into that, what do people need to believe? And you just like hit it. They need to believe that the result is possible. Again, you know, examples certainly help that.
Yeah, and they need to believe that it's not just a few prophets in the wilderness singing songs.
Yeah.
You just made a marvelous face, Beatrice.
Just as Hildy, like, I have so many thoughts happening through my head. But Dimitri, you wanted to talk, go ahead.
The thing that I suddenly noticed, I hadn't noticed it so much because your hair is long, but I suddenly noticed that you and I are dressed the same.
That's the message.
If both of our heads explode, it must be the shirt. I'm going to mute Dimitri so you can talk.
I think the part of the example and part of the discussion is that in terms of human history, we are at a point right now that has never existed before. One of the things that exists in this point is surplus. There is so much surplus. When you go back to the 100,000 years and you're talking about competition and you're talking about, you know, how our brains evolved to try to deal with scarcity, it was real. I mean, you know, you could die tomorrow from starvation. You know, if you couldn't find enough roots and you couldn't trap a squirrel or, you know, whatever it was, that was very real. Right now, not that hunger isn't real now, but the resources, the surplus, massive surplus exists. You know, this country throws away more food than is necessary to feed everybody else on the planet. I mean, it's just ridiculous when you think about it in that context. Also, right now, we don't suffer from disease the way that you know, our ancestors did. Part of why we live so long is because we, you know, have figured out, you know, oh, don't drink water that's sitting in a puddle, and don't, you know, I mean, just run down the, you know, up to and including penicillin and antibiotics and whatever. But that's because we've reached this point. And the other thing that is happening right now is communication. Look at what we are doing right now, this very second. You know, we are having a conversation across the continent as if we're in our living rooms, and we're sharing ideas and doing amazing stuff together. So all of these things are kind of converging, that is part of the examples that are given to folks so that they can cognitively feel it and hopefully emotionally feel it once, you know, as they start accepting these realities. So.
As for me, like, so many thoughts that I have, but like, for example, like thinking about, I just love that concept, Hildy, that about the collective enoughness. And I think that, right, like what you just said, Dimitri, about the surplus, like we don't realize like how much we actually do have. And working in organizations that have those resources that, you know, we want to make an impact, have a change, and we receive grants, and it's like, okay, we have all this pool of money. How are we actually going to be using it in where to be able to have that impact that we want to have? And it just, it makes it so difficult to bring all that thought together of, you know, there are the resources, even if our communities are, you know, we are suffering still from hunger and some people are still enslaved in some ways. And how do we put all that together? And I know I'm not making much sense. It's just like I have thoughts in my head, realizing like, you know, again, with the surplus in this country, for example, healthcare, it's so advanced. And at the same time, people are not having the proper care that we have in other countries that might not be as rich like mine, because we have a universal healthcare system. So putting all those things together is just so much.
Well, and what... Now you know what my brain feels like every day. So I'm when you see the possibilities, your head explodes. What I'm taking from what both of you are talking about is one of the things that people need to see is the resources that do exist, and see resources in a very, very different way. The fact that we see resources as money rather than seeing resources as cars and buildings and people and et cetera. You can't share a dollar bill, but you can share a car and you can share a building, and the making the invisible visible about the resources that are there waiting to be tapped, no matter how devastated poor a community is. They have a vacant storefront. They have somebody who knows how to fix cars. I mean, so we have so much resource, and we devalue the stuff we really need, and we value the placeholder that gets us the stuff we really need. And the placeholder is just money. All it is a means of exchange, what I have for what you have and that I want. Well, what if we got rid of the middleman? What if we said, what I need is an office space, and you have a vacant building? We don't need this. We can just talk. And there is really so much power in what you both are talking about, that we pull back the curtain, that one of the things people need to know is there is enough. There is enough of what we need. If we stop thinking about what we need is the means of exchange, and we start thinking about what we need is, oh, look, you've got three cars, two of them are sitting in your driveway all the time, those kinds of things. I think there's something powerful in that.
You know, there's an expression, I'm going to put, she with the most toys wins. Change that mindset. She with the most connections. Mm-hmm. Wins. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that becomes what's valued, not accumulation of stuff.
And that is also making me think about this world of individualism versus collectivity, and how, you know, in other cultures, that closeness between communities. And I remember, you know, I used to live in an apartment building. You knew all your neighbors, so you know that if there's something that you need, you can knock on your next door neighbor and see if they have it. But this country, for example, is just so individualistic that for many years I didn't know my neighbors. And it's like how disconnected we are, and not wanting to show kind of weakness because we cannot provide for something, when actually, you know, it's actually something that somebody else has available. If I cannot afford it, or if I don't have it right at this moment, why cannot I ask for it?
Ooh, that vulnerability piece. Go, Anne.
There's a very big part of the traditional American culture that we are really seeking to change here. Individuality is certainly one of its, self-reliance is another one. The whole capitalistic system that says it is incredibly important to have a lot, whatever a lot is. But I mean, you talk about the organization that gets the grant and how are we going to distribute these funds to have the impact we want. But somewhere in the system, somebody says, yeah, but you know, Mary Sue is not earning enough money, so we're going to give her a raise. And we have this huge administrative overhead that we have to maintain because I have to put my kids through college. You know, it's very, very warped in so many ways. I think what we're saying is that we're part of a larger movement that I see brewing worldwide to change the dynamics of people's goals in life. And that particularly means changing the greed system, if you will. I mean, I knew we were in trouble when I went to see a movie with Michael Douglas and he said greed was good. And I thought, this is a big movie. A lot of people are going to see it, and they're going to believe this. The changes that we're trying to effect are fundamental, and what I really was going for is, therefore, one of the things that we have to keep clear is simplicity. That people have to really see that message simply, the way you did it in Fresno with that one day. No. You have one mission, and this is it. And it was something that everybody could understand.
Yep. A couple things, and then I want to introduce Peter and welcome him, because I'm very, very glad you're here. Can you hear us, Peter?
I can, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Awesome.
Excellent.
Awesome. Riffing off of what you all are talking about, and Peter, mostly we've been spending time with our heads exploding, so I'll just let you know that.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you all looked a little different today.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we're just completely blowed up. And the whole piece about people need to, in this place of connection. And Peter, we've been really talking about, we prioritized of all of the high potential outcomes that we had come up with last time, and sort of I summarized into pulling them together in groups. We realized that connecting with others who want the same results as us was probably the most important for us to focus on, in part because it felt like a prerequisite to everything else. People will feel agency if they feel that connection. They'll feel, and so what we've really been talking about are what are the conditions for that connection? What do people need to feel in order to connect around? And we've been specifically looking at the systems change, systems reimagining. Stuff that you and I have been talking about quite a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
And you're talking about people need to, in order to feel that sense of connection and to want to connect to have these conversations, people need to see this as part of a larger movement that already exists. There is something really huge in that, to see that the world has already changed. This is not anticipating something we think is going to happen, that these shifts have already occurred and that the social change arena has not kept up with that. Mm-hmm. I don't know that any systems have. I don't know that any system. I think that's why we're seeing the massive reactionary forces at play globally, because the world has changed and there are folks clawing on to the old systems because we don't have a new one to go to yet.
Right, right.
And I'm really, really feeling that. And I'm and again, one of the things, Peter, that I was sharing with everybody is the one of the keynotes that I'm going to be doing in San Francisco next week. The title of the conference is "Can Your .org Make It in a Hashtag World?"
Huh.
As we're looking at individual organizations versus the connectedness of a hashtag, and you know, we were talking about hashtags last time about the power of everybody feeling like they're part of something. And a big, huge piece of what I'm going to be talking about, and I'm not surprised, Anne, that you read my mind, because you always do, is is the fact that what the world is looking for in social change is dramatically different than it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily, we all still have the same systems we had 20 years ago. We may have tweaked it so that, oh, now we have social media fundraising, but we haven't dramatically changed the thinking, but the world's thinking has shifted dramatically. And Anne, I think it's really, really powerful that that is it. An absolute condition for success is that people see that and acknowledge their own frustration, because we're all seeing it and sensing it in different ways. And we may be very, very conscious that we're sensing it, or we may be in that place of, so that's why it hasn't been working. But I do think that's a big one.
This is, it sounds like I missed some good stuff. Sorry, I have to join late, because these are some ideas that did not come out last week, and they add a lot to the conversation. So glad to have you all here sharing this. So.
Very, very, very exciting. So what we're really focusing on are what are the conditions for success, and acknowledging that conditions for success are always people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been asking things like, in order for us to be connecting and people to be connecting in general around this topic of reimagining the systems, what do the people that we want to speak with or whom we want to speak with each other, what do they need to know? What do they need to believe? What do they need to feel? What do they need to be assured of? And you started talking about what they need to believe. They need to believe that the results are possible, that it's not just, as you said it, a few prophets in the wilderness. I'm sort of playing with the, I think people need to believe that, trying to figure out how to say this. So many of the things that we have valued in the past, well, I guess it's true. What we value, we bring into fruition. So we may say that we value our family more than anything, but if we really value keeping our job, and then we're going to be at the office 18 hours a day and won't see our family. So I think what we truly value comes out in our actions, and we have valued for a very long time, and this has to do with the individualism and everything, we have valued hard skills, metrics, the business mentality of competition. All of these things have been at the core of what we have valued, and we have devalued what we see as human connection and the touchy-feely stuff. So when you were talking about, you know, this isn't just a few prophets out in the wilderness, that was sort of where my head went, Anne, was that sense of, oh, you guys are so cute talking about all that human feeling stuff, when in fact that's the only thing that ever really happens, is how people feel about it. So I'm babbling, but there's something really powerful in there.
Well, I think coming off of that, though, too, we are at an interesting time where corporate America is making proclamations that their business isn't just to serve shareholders anymore; it's to it's to serve the greater good and to have their employees and customers as stakeholders now. So I there is some movement that's happening in terms of what people are valuing. At the same point, on the other end of things, there's this just, you know, overall political hardening and nationalism and some of those other things that are working against that. So there's a lot of friction right now that that we have to be mindful of, too.
Absolutely.
I think we have to be mindful of it as we proceed, but I think earlier Hildy said something to the effect that a lot of that, as we see it happening now worldwide, is the word establishment is not quite right, but the established set of values is congealing and fighting back, because the change is beginning to percolate into all sorts of parts of the community. Some of the last parts are the most interesting parts. I was, when you were talking about professors that and various people that should be part of the target audience, if you will, I suddenly thought of all the professional schools, lawyers, doctors, accountants. Every one of those is an area where rigid how-to is absolutely the way it is, and it's not to change. And that's going to be interesting, because that's also very much a part of the power structure.
Yeah, well, and again, some of the stuff that we were talking about people who think that I'm just and talking about things bubbling up, laws change when people change. And when people demand that they change, and accounting systems, we've never, as a sector, when I say sector, I really hold that very loosely, as a social change arena, we've never created accounting systems that work for us. Boards spend the only reports boards spend most of their time looking at are the same reports that a board of a business would look at. So they're not looking at, okay, that's great, we had a profit last year, but did we create change? Did we connect in the community? Did we connect with all of those? One of the things we were talking about prior, Peter, was the extent to which there is an abundance of resource. There's an abundance of stuff out there that we don't even see that. Where was the last time you saw that on a budget? I mean, when I teach, create a budget that has the resource sharing as part of your budget. But aside from food banks, who will tell you that they have a $12 million budget and only $2 million of that is cash, because they count what they get in beans and canned goods as the value. We don't do that. When we were back in our consulting days, we were working, and actually it was the same project that I was talking about earlier, when we were working with the funder and bringing these people together in this learning community. One of the organizations had a room that was about 1,000 square feet designated in their facility. That was, they were a transitional housing group, and which is never about housing. It's always about transitional lives. I wish we'd stop talking about transitional housing. But they had 1,000 square feet set aside where it was basically closet. It was, do you need anything? As you're in this transition, do you need anything? And it was 100% donated goods, run 100% by volunteers, and it was 100% absent from all of their financial statements. Because it was all donated goods, it wasn't money, and it was all volunteers, there was no money. And it was this huge thing. So how are we telling our story in terms of connecting? So getting back to the accounting thing, Anne, there's a piece there about seeing a different way, and we've been talking about that a lot, is seeing examples of a different way, showing what a budget looks like when it is not two columns in and out, but three columns. Here's the stuff. Here's how much of it we got in kind, and here's how much of it we had to pay cash for, and here's what it really looks like. There's a big piece there about telling the whole story. And again, it's about what's really going on. And yeah, I'm babbling. I'm sorry.
No, you're not babbling, Hildy. I think like it's what you said, like all these things like spark so many other thoughts. Like, for example, when you were talking about badges, that one of the things that came to my mind is I've been talking to a few organizations around the country that they've heard from their clients how they have forgotten their mission because they've been so focused on numbers and so focused on deliverables to funders and the boards and, you know, that doing those budgets that fall under what they are supposed to be doing, that they have kind of forgotten the community and what the community actually needs. And so they are just focusing on, okay, so the money is coming from here and this is what they want to do with that money, instead of going to the community and asking them, okay, what is what the community needs? So sometimes we are just so focused on what they are telling us up here that we don't bring up what the community actually needs. And then the other thing that I was also thinking when Anne was talking, and it's that idea as well of as soon as, you know, like when these conversations start to happen, you give people a voice that they didn't realize they had, that everyone is bringing something to the table and creating those leaders that, you know, they might not see themselves as change makers, but in their communities, they are, just because we are actually willing to listen to them. And again, it kind of fits with what I was saying before. When you ask the community, what is that you need? These conversations start to happen and the bubble up happens.
Yes. Yes. Well, and it brings up one of the points that we were talking about last time. And you mentioned that the language needs to be simple. The fact that what people need to see and hear and feel is language that makes sense to them. Language that resonates with them. And you know, we in doing this work are as bad as everybody else in terms of jargon and acronyms and all of that stuff. But one of the things that was most interesting when I was speaking at the conference in Milan earlier this year is it was an international conference. There were people from I think 90 different countries or 70 different countries. And while I knew this, I was pleased that the organizer was very explicit about it, saying, for many people here, English is not their first language. For many people here, English is not even their second language. And so use small words. I mean, it was just this delightful use small words. And I tend to know that. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what are the small words, but it's something as simple as that. I think that what people need to see, and we talked about it last time a lot, is that it needs to be language that meets them where they are, not language we think is cool to use or the jargony thing. The thing that I sent you, Peter, last week, it was, I may actually post it in the blog post on this. It was one of the most jargon rich. It was a little thing on Instagram, so it could only be this big, and I've never seen that many words shoved together that I didn't know what they meant.
Yeah, it was philanthropic word salad is what that was, and but yeah, I think you're gonna have to blur her face out if you use it.
That's why I haven't done it so far. yeah and one of the other things that we talked about last time is that I think in order to build the connections, people need to be able to easily share what they hear. And that has to do with the simplicity of language as well. So we've been talking a lot about connecting with this concept, really. It's not just connecting with us, but connecting with this concept that systems that reimagining the systems that support change, fundraising and evaluation and all of that, connecting with their power to even just get involved in that. I may not be able to make the change, but I'm curious and I'd like to know more. What would it take? What would people need to know? What would they need to feel to want to know more, to be intrigued? stories occurs to me, but there's something bigger there.
Maybe a way to picture themselves in this.
Okay, I'm going to mute so that you can talk.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to say.
Oh, is that?
No. A way of picturing themselves in this world, whatever that means. You know, so they could see themselves. Because we all see ourselves now in what we do and who we are. And so, you know, a way of seeing themselves in this, and some of it is seeing themselves with their friends, and some of it is seeing themselves, you know, in their family and whatnot, but it has to be real to them.
Yeah. And I'm thinking as well is, again, related to that, Dimitri, feeling that one is understood, that these things that you are feeling, that you think about, is not only you, but there's other people around you that have these same concerns and wonders or questions. And when you find those people and are able to talk to them, like I've noticed, like you feel like so relaxed, thinking, oh my God, I'm not alone.
Wow, yes.
Yeah, you were. I think so many of the people that we will be talking to already feel that they are outside or outsiders. And what Beatrice has said is, and what building on what Dimitri is saying is, it not only that they can be an insider, but they already are. Oh,
wow.
You know, I'm going to mute them now. I think about how this is used in advertising now. And the thought that comes to mind is going to a movie and watching the Coca-Cola commercial before the movie. And all the different groups and people and relationships and whatever all tied together by Coca-Cola. But it is giving an example. Oh, it's a biracial couple? Great. You know, here, you guys drink Coke too. Oh, it is a little old lady pushing the baby cart. Oh, you drink Coke too. So that you see yourself in this by being given examples of such a wide range of social status types, orientations, etc.
What else? What do people need to feel or to see, to know in order to feel intrigued to want to have more conversation?
They have to feel like, and this has a lot to do with a lot of the disruption and change we've seen in a lot of other areas. They have to feel like they are part of it and are shaping it rather than it being something that's being presented to them. If this is going to be a movement, if this is really going to take hold, it can't be us just talking at people. It has to be them shaping the message themselves.
Absolutely.
And also making them feel that they are bringing something to the table, that there is a part of their expertise, whatever that is, that they can put towards this work, this movement.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole building it together thing.
Just a quick share.
Yeah.
They are building it together.
Yeah.
And they feel all part of it. So.
Yeah, it's huge. I'm coming back. We talked earlier. You can't help in these past few days, Peter, but talk about Greta Thunberg. and the power of what one shy, self-admittedly shy, child created in terms of the ripples of people feeling their own agency, feeling like they could do something. It comes back to, I think people need to see examples, they need to see stories. There is huge power in rabble rousing, and there's huge power in quiet conversation. And I think that what people like, and I know I so constantly come back to the very loud voices of Dan Pallotta and Voulez. Dan Pallotta, the last time I looked, his TED Talk, pardon me, about the way we think about charity, had almost 5 million views. Vu's blog has something like 32,000 followers. And that's just subscribers. That's not people who, you know, share it via Facebook and et cetera. That's actual subscribers. They're striking a chord, and one tends to be much more gracious than the other, but they're rabble rousing and they're striking a chord. And that is necessary. That is absolutely necessary. When it comes, though, to our goal here of connecting and people seeing people connecting with what we're trying to accomplish, there's the other side of that, which is doing the quiet work, the honoring work, the valuing them work, the listening work. And I think there's a big piece there about the asking and listening. One of the questions I've been asking as so a little bit of history. I started out this year having just information gathering, sleuthing conversations with foundation heads and people who are movers and shakers in the quote unquote capacity building world to get a sense of who's pushing the boundaries on capacity building, who's looking at this stuff differently. And it was through those conversations that I started to go, nobody appears to be just saying we need to blow it all up and start over again. They're saying it differently in different places, but nobody who actually has the power to say we're going to do things completely different is actually blowing stuff up. But there's power in having conversations that aren't, I want to tell you this, versus I'd like to know what you're seeing out in the world. An invitation to learn from them rather than teach. I think there's, and I'm not entirely clear in my head as I'm saying it, but there's something powerful in the invitation, in it being an invitation to share what you're seeing, and then we can have an exchange. Oh, this is what I'm seeing. But there's something in there that has to be inviting.
You're talking about this, Hilde, and I'm thinking about the Harwood Institute. I know the Patterson Foundation also taught it, and they said that instead of turning inward, turning outward.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people need to feel invited. I can't say the number of times people have said in my career, oh, I didn't know I could join. I mean, you know, I used to do that when I used to teach governance, and I wasn't even teaching governance when I was a consultant and I was helping boards do recruitment, and I would suggest, well, what about this person or what about that person? They would consistently say, they know we're here. If they wanted to be on the board, they would have asked. And the number of times, it's like, people just assume inside organizations that, well, I don't want to impose, they would have asked. And the number of times they went out and asked that person and that person said, you want me? I'm so honored, you want me? So I think that there's a really big piece about being very explicit in an invitation, and Peter, you nailed it, an invitation to explore together and build something together. and to be very mindful to say, we don't know what the it is that we're going to build together, but if we're going to build it, we have to build. There's something really powerful in that. It's going to be fun to try and summarize this one.
Another thing I was thinking when you were talking about this is just how, you know, when people don't feel that they are invited to certain rooms, then it doesn't give a full picture to the people that are already on those rooms. And I'm thinking specifically about the Hispanic community. It's such a big, so many people fall under that label. And for example, I didn't know I belong into that label until I came to this country and they gave it to me. I'm from Spain, so for me, Latinos are Latinos and I'm from Spain. But now, and being in DC, it's making me more aware that there are many people that are considered Latinos for the rest of the world, but that themselves don't feel that they are invited under the Latino label. And I'm thinking, you know, the indigenous people that come from Guatemala, mostly right now that are here in this country, Afro-Latinos, are as well, like they don't feel that are part of the conversations, the issues that Latinos care about. And it's heartbreaking that, you know, first that I didn't know, and that I wasn't aware of some of those distinctions, and that, you know, everyone else puts them under a label that they don't feel identified with. And so they feel completely outsiders, both in the Anglo and American label and also in the Latino label. And so you just feel, so what is your identity? Where do you belong?
Wow. Yeah. Yes. It's another silo we've invented.
One of the things that this makes me think about, and it's something you touched upon, Beatrice, before this, which was inviting people in who aren't regularly invited in. And what I was reflecting on is many years ago, we were working with a community health organization. And it was a federally chartered community health organization. So a requirement was that a certain percentage of the board had to be clients of the organization. And what was really interesting about that is, the first of all, the, oh my God, you know, I'm just a farm worker. Just whatever, you want me to, you know, to be on this board? Yes. And what did they contribute in terms of the reality of what this organization was doing to the board's knowledge? You know, because it's one thing when staff says, oh, we're doing great, or, you know, someone comes in to complain about something and you hear that voice. But do you hear the voice of the people who are being served? And what areas are, you know, is there room for improvement, or are ideas that haven't been incorporated or whatnot? So I think the power of bringing the unlikely suspects into the room and giving them an equal seat is really, really powerful toward crafting answers that you wouldn't have come to without that.
Yeah, and one of the my head's exploding. One of the ripples of that is when you can begin to see your agency, your power in one place, that ripples into seeing it elsewhere. So if I am just a person, I'm just a community member, I'm just a citizen, you want me to sit at this table? And if being at the table isn't Yeah, but the three white guys are always the ones talking, and everybody else sitting around the table is sitting quietly because they don't feel, and the three white guys are the ones who are pretty happy to just keep talking. If, again, systems are supporting, really honoring all of the voices in the room, that is a training ground for somebody who didn't think they had a voice to potentially step into having a voice in another arena. Oh, I may speak out at a PTA meeting, and it never occurred to me to speak out at a PTA meeting.
So, Hilda, there's a question from Mark Friesen.
Yes.
And first of all, he's thanking us for the terrific perspectives that we have here. And the question is, what does an integrity-based board look like?
That was from another. That's a tweet from another thing that was looking at our board meeting.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Thank you, Mark, for looking at our board meeting. one of the interesting things about and I think that this has a place here. I'm not sure where, but this is a communications tool. What we're doing right now, and so there's. It is really interesting to see the number of people who watch our meetings afterwards. So they have examples they can point to for their for the people they're working with. So we've been talking so much about people need to see examples and see stories, and the fact that other people are tweeting about our board meeting that happened 3-4 months ago to look at the focus of that. But there's something, again, powerful about seeing it. And I hate to say this, but we are about to wrap up, and I would like us all to first take just a deep breath. This has been an amazing, amazing conversation. And if you took some notes, circle what's standing out to you. If you didn't take some notes, take a moment to think, and let's just share a moment of reflection of what is standing out to you from our conversation today? What are ahas? What are some of the big takeaways that you're taking away? And whoever comes up with one first, just dive on in.
For me, it was just what Dimitri said about that example of the board bringing clients. Like, I cannot believe that I've sat in, 2-3 boards when I was in Sarasota and had never even thought about bringing a client. And we're always right, like trying, those are the people that we're helping, and I'm complaining because, you know, the staff doesn't represent the clients that we're serving. And I'm like, why didn't you think about the board and bringing those clients? For me, that really blew my mind.
Well, I was admittedly a little late to the party today, but I was really struck by kind of the recap you gave me at the beginning, Hilde, of what you talked about before I joined, and connecting this to the fact that a lot of these, what we're attempting to do with this is really connecting to things that are already happening, and the field just hasn't really either recognized it or figured out how to play a more important role in it.
Yeah, thanks. I'm so glad you're here.
Me too.
I have to say that the big thing that stood out for me was meeting Beatrice. Thank you for all that you've done, and I really look forward to meeting you again.
You too, Anna. This has been such a pleasure. Such a great, great getting together.
Early in this, somebody said, and somebody seconded it, so I wrote it down twice, but it was, anyone can change the questions they ask. And I just thought, we've got to remember that the thing that's so incredibly powerful about all of this is its absolute simplicity.
Very much so. And Dimitri, I will mute, and if you will share your reflection.
Actually, my reflection happened right at the very end here, which frequently happens. And that is, when you were talking about people coming back and watching board meetings and watching meetings and watching whatever, there is an entire culture built around creating videos
around how to carve an onion, how to, you know, whatever. I went to this concert. I did this, I did that. I don't know that there's many, video memes around this kind of stuff that is equally available and encourages people to grow in their own thinking and in their own organizations without it being monetized. Because so often, all of those actions are taken so that I can have the sponsor, you know, hold up the Arnova cup of coffee, you know, where I'm at here or whatever. And so I'm just sort of reflecting on, obviously, this has been an amazing conversation, and really building on the last meeting we had, but also that this itself is creating something that answers many of the questions that we were asking and talking about. So that's my reflection.
There's, I'll just say everything. the book, The Culture Code, which if you haven't read it, it's awesome. It is just an awesome recap of successful organizational cultures, what is going on. And he really talks about three things. One is a sense of purpose, a shared sense of purpose. And we talked about that so much. Anne was bringing up the thing that I had said years ago that when I was teaching in her community about the fact that all these organizations may see themselves as having separate missions, but we all want the same thing. I'm thinking of the interview that I did with Carol Rasko for the podcast, Peter. Carol Rasko was the domestic policy advisor for Bill Clinton. And given the absolute hatred of the Clintons from way before they even got into a national office, the fact that they passed so much domestic policy, and I asked Carol, how are you able to do that? And she said, when I walked into a room, I knew that my job was to find what everybody had in common. And I'm thinking about that shared purpose, and I'm thinking about the book, The Culture Code, where he also talks about shared purpose. He talks about the need for safety, and we talked so much today about people feeling like they're not going to be attacked. Instead, you've been screwing up all this time, and that need for safety and the ability to be vulnerable and modeling vulnerability. And I'm really seeing those themes. Other people will be vulnerable. We talked last time about the first follower thing. Other people will be vulnerable if they see others being vulnerable. And it's, you're more likely to step into that. And so there's just all of those thoughts are sort of flowing through. Those are all standing out for me all at the same time. And the thought that Beatrice is a very good dresser. very, very quickly, I will just share with folks who are watching what we're going to be going next time. Let me get that out of there. What we've really been talking about today is all in this column here. What are the conditions for success? If people are going to connect, feel their agency, feel their power, have the courage, what do they need to feel and what do they need to know? Because that is what we want our communications to create. We want our communications to create all of those feelings and sentiments and knowledge and understanding and beliefs that we talked about today. And so the next step when we get together is going to really be looking at, okay, what do we want to do? What actions will lead to that? And what we'll wind up doing is I will slowly, this one's going to be, thank goodness we're going to be in the car for a while. I can listen to this meeting several times. And pull some of these thoughts together, these threads together. Just like we did today, we started by prioritizing. We can prioritize which are the conditions we think are the most important, and we can start to really unpack those. What will it take for people to feel that? If we want them to feel valued, what would it take? What would they need to know to feel valued? What would they need to experience to feel valued? Walking those backwards, and our actions will come out of that. We don't have that meeting scheduled right now, but we will be talking about that. It'll probably be after Dimitri and I get back from driving all around California. But I just want to express deep, deep gratitude to the brilliance that you all shared, and I just love having you around. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.